all goes well, and everybody should keep their cosmic fingers crossed, 1997 should be the year of Comet Hale-Bopp, which promises to be one of the brightest comets of the 20th century.
Looking forward to the new year. I'm Daniel Zwerdling with All Things Considered. Celestial events are just one reason to anticipate 1997 with mixed emotions. Here on Earth, the people of Serbia are divided, their country shaken by protests. Here in America, the religious right continues to gain ground, even though their candidate lost the presidential election. And the nation will be a sadder place now that some great entertainers have died.
He says, I know we ain't never been good friends, but says, please, vote for me. I need your vote. Lim says, I wouldn't vote for you if you were St. Peter himself. He says, listen, if I was St. Peter, you couldn't vote for me. You wouldn't be in my district.
Looking back and ahead after news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. The Marxist rebels holding hostages at the Japanese ambassador's residence in Lima today released 20 more captives, leaving a total of 83 inside the compound. The release followed the first face-to-face contact between the rebels and a government negotiator. Domingo Palermo spent more than 3 hours inside the residence. The Tupac Amaro Revolutionary Movement also issued a statement with the freed captives, which was broadcast live on radio and television, including CNN.
It's unfortunate that some political VIPs and journalists are insisting in calling us as only a band of terrorists, which is totally untrue because there are not any facts to support it. We do not accept that we are continue to be compared to Shining Path, an organization which we have condemned time and again because they have used violence which is irrational and it has affected the people.
The guerrillas have released more than 420 hostages since storming the residence during a cocktail party on December 17th. The remaining hostages include those considered by the guerrillas as their best bargaining chips, including top Peruvian officials, the Japanese, Bolivian, and Honduran ambassadors, and Japanese VIPs. The Guatemalan government and rebel forces are poised to sign a peace treaty Sunday to end 36 years of civil war, the longest in Latin America. James Bleers reports.
Security surrounding the ceremony is going to be extremely tight. The Guatemalans are determined there'll be no repeat of the Peruvian hostage situation. Each country in the region, plus the Organization of American States, will be represented. To reach this point, President Alvaro Arzu constantly nudged the peace talks in Mexico City along, fully aware of the awful consequences of failure. The three-decade-old civil war had already claimed more than 140,000 lives. Guatemala must now ensure the guerrillas peacefully disarm with the help of the United Nations, welcome back thousands of refugees which have been displaced during the war, and rebuild its shattered economy. For National Public Radio, I'm James Blears in Mexico City.
The White House insisted today that a presidential aide solicited no contributions from Asian Americans, despite her role supervising a vast election year outreach plan targeted to that community. Spokesman Lanny Davis said presidential aide Doris Matsui avoided fundraising in her post as director of White House outreach to Asian Americans. South Korean officials say North Korea has agreed to apologize for its September infiltration of a spy submarine into South Korea. The officials say the North just disagrees on how the apology will be made. A North Korean apology is a key South Korean demand for improved relations and economic aid. You're listening to National Public Radio News. Residents in the Pacific Northwest got a chance to shovel themselves out today as the region got a respite from the week's snow and ice storms. But more storms are forecast. From member station KPLU in Seattle, Ingrid Lobet reports.
Until now, retailers had seen very little of the usually heavy post-Christmas shopping. Several department stores even closed due to dangerous roads and few customers. Even though many streets remain impassable throughout Western Washington, people did get out today, and the downtown Seattle area was full of shoppers. Trucks that had been stranded on the major cross-country routes also have been able to resume their journeys. Nevertheless, more than 100,000 people are still without power, and dozens of metro buses still sit where they were stranded on Thursday. Business is by no means back to normal. And the Weather Service says another storm is on the way. 3 to 10 more inches of snow are predicted for Seattle by the end of the weekend. For National Public Radio, I'm Ingrid Lobet in Seattle.
The Dallas Cowboys began the defense of their Super Bowl title in the NFL playoffs this afternoon. Glenn Mitchell reports from Dallas.
The Dallas Cowboys said they wanted to make a statement to the rest of the league going into the postseason. They did it this afternoon at the expense of the visiting Minnesota Vikings, using Minnesota mistakes to key a 40-15 first-round playoff win. The Cowboys' offense, sluggish for most of the season, looked sharp as running back Emmitt Smith and receiver Michael Irvin both topped 100 yards. Smith set an NFL record for the most 100-yard games in the postseason. And the defense, which kept Dallas in so many games this year, notched 5 turnovers, including 3 interceptions. Dallas goes to Carolina to play the Panthers next Sunday. In today's AFC matchup, Jacksonville upset the Bills in Buffalo 30-27. For National Public Radio, this is Glenn Mitchell in Dallas.
That's a summary of some of the day's top stories. I'm Frank Stachowiak, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Negotiations in Peru and more hostages released. It's All Things Considered. I'm Daniel Zwerdling. Marxist guerrillas at the Japanese ambassador's residence in the capital of Lima released 20 more captives today, the 12th day of the crisis. Most of the captives emerged from the compound after the rebels released a statement in which they deplored being labeled as terrorists. A total of 80 hostages remain. The release followed more than 3 hours of face-to-face negotiations, the first between the rebels and the Peruvian government's chief negotiator. Reporter John Miller joins us on the line now from Lima. John, does the release today suggest that the sides are softening their positions?
Well, there have been releases before, so that's not necessarily a sign of softening. I think what might be seen as a sign of softening, though, is the very fact that President Fujimori sent in his chief negotiator to meet head-to-head with these rebels. If not the sign of softening, then at least maybe some development of some level of trust between the two sides. Fujimori has been very, very silent through this whole thing. He said he will not negotiate as long as hostages remain, as long as the rebels keep their guns. But it's hard to imagine that Education Minister Palermo, the chief negotiator, did all the talking in a meeting that lasted nearly 3.5 hours. They must have talked about the rebel demands and listened to the rebel demands. The very fact that the government allowed the rebels to present their statement as a condition for releasing the hostages was a sort of a concession that the government was made, and probably the small sort of concession they will be willing to make over time. On the rebel side, just letting the negotiator in and then letting him out demonstrates, if not a softening, at least that they're serious about talking. But in their statement, they did say that their demands have not changed.
Let's talk more about that statement in just a minute. Who was released today, and who remains in the compound?
Those released today included the ambassador to Malaysia, the ambassador from Malaysia, the ambassador from the Dominican Republic, about 6 members of the Peruvian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and about a dozen Japanese embassy officials and business executives, some from large Japanese corporations, some middle-level executives, and some upper executives as well.
And who remains inside the compound?
The remaining group includes the ambassador of Bolivia, the ambassador of Honduras, the consul general of Argentina, a couple of cabinet members, the minister of agriculture, and the foreign minister from Peru. The chief justice of the Supreme Court is in there, the head of state security. There's half a dozen police generals and congressmen. Executive. This is a very, very important group of people, and one person who is important certainly for President Fujimori is his younger brother, Pedro.
Oh, who's still in the compound. Yeah, you mentioned that it was a big deal that the chief negotiator for the government handled the negotiations today, the first. Is there any sign that these negotiations are going to continue, that today was just the opening day of an ongoing dialogue between the rebels and the government?
I think there's a recognition on both sides that this is a process that's going to have to take some time. The fact that all the rebels, that all the hostages weren't freed by the rebels in one fell swoop, I think demonstrates that they're playing their cards quite carefully. They're letting people go as they see they can. They're obviously not giving up in this thing. The fact that the negotiator went to the compound, had a meeting, I think presages future meetings of this sort.
John, we have only 20 seconds left. Quickly, the rebels said they don't want to be thought of as terrorists. What do they want to be thought of as?
Well, they want to be, they say they want to be part of the political process here, and the only reason they did what they did was because they couldn't get the attention of the public any other way. They've been complaining that they've been labeled terrorists all along. I think that that's a message that the Peruvian people are not terribly sensitive to. They're a bit fed up with politics and guns.
Thanks very much, reporter John Miller in Lima, Peru.
Thank you, Denny.
When an anti-government protester was killed earlier this week in the streets of Belgrade, in the worst day of violence since the massive protests began, hardly anybody knew his name but his friends and family. He was Predrag Starčević, 39 years old, and today thousands of demonstrators followed his casket to the cemetery, turning his funeral into another protest against the government of President Slobodan Milosevic, who overturned the opposition party's victories in municipal elections last month. From Belgrade, NPR's Edward Lifson reports.
Belgrade's Novogrobje Cemetery was covered with snow. Alleys of trees framed the picture. The opposition hoped to create the first martyr for their anti-Milosevic movement. They moved their daily protest rally from Republic Square to the cemetery. In the past few days, the numbers of the crowds in Republic Square had been falling, along with the temperatures. On Saturday, the main newspaper from Milosevic's own Socialist Party surprisingly published the full findings of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which stated that the opposition coalition had won control of many towns and municipalities in the November 17th elections that President Milosevic does not want to recognize. For today's protests, only a few thousand people showed up in the cemetery. There was no visible police presence. Father Žarko Gavrilović, a bearded Orthodox priest in black robes, gave a short speech, both personal and political.
We are paying our police forces to save and to keep the peace, not to beat their own citizens.
The three opposition leaders walked behind the black hearse, along with Starčević's widow. They wound through the cemetery past snow-covered tombstones with Cyrillic lettering. Flocks of birds flew overhead. The slow cortege passed the chapel. The protesters who came to the cemetery today blamed their president for the killing. Olga Maric is a hairdresser in her 40s.
Who is next tomorrow? I don't know. Communists.
She spits on the ground. Another woman answers her.
They're not communists. They're terrorists.
At the gravesite, Mother Angelina of Serbia, an Orthodox nun, drew on the nationalist sentiment prevalent in Serbia, and she indicted the United States for not entering in the fight against Milosevic.
Serbs are living on their historical territory. This communist, cursed communist Milosevic, is against the Serbian people. We are pure Democrats, Christians, and that Orthodox. And if America is so Christian and so democratic, she will help us now. God bless you.
Not everyone thought this was the time and place for such speeches. One man stepped forward.
I'm just a citizen of Belgrade. I think, you know, everything is clear. This is not a place to talk like this.
People placed yellow mimosa on the mound of dirt until the flowers piled up waist high. They cradled candles against the wind. The flames would not stay lit until there were enough candles all together to create a blaze. Slowly, the mourners walked down the hill, through the nearby streets, and they blew whistles and kazoos as they have during their protests. Some walked from the cemetery to downtown Republic Square, where their rallies are usually held, and where a protest rally is called once again for tomorrow afternoon. It will be the 40th consecutive day of these actions, calling for President Milosevic to abide by the results of the November 17th municipal elections. Western pressure is mounting on Milosevic for authentic democratic reforms. In Belgrade, I'm Edward Lifson reporting.
Canada is a land of low crime rates and generous health insurance and ethnic diversity. It's also a haven for Nazi war criminals, or at least that's the way some Jewish organizations see it. They charge that dozens of former Nazis are living comfortably across Canada, yet they say government officials virtually refuse to prosecute or deport them. Canadian officials deny it, as Carolyn Jack reports from Toronto.
This small knotted rug is one of the few mementos that Vera Peter has of her mother.
I remember how my mother made it. If you want to see, there are two colors here. there is a borderline.
In 1944, Vera and her whole family were rounded up from their home in a Hungarian village and sent to Auschwitz.
I was with another cousin of mine, the only one who survived. And all the others were exterminated right there in Auschwitz.
Vera left Europe after the war and came here to Toronto, where she had a family and rebuilt her life, far from the painful reminders of the Holocaust.
Until we found out last February that there is a Nazi war criminal amongst us.
Just a few floors up from Vera Peter's condominium lives Conrad Kalej. Kalej resided in Chicago for over 30 years. In 1985, the U.S. Office of Special Investigations accused him of having been the commander of a Latvian execution squad during the Nazi era. His case went through 8 years of appeal. Three different courts found the charges to be true. Kalej was deported from the United States in 1994. And after a few months, he came to Canada as a tourist. He bought a condo on the 17th floor of Vera Peters' comfortable building in North Toronto and moved in. Mrs. Peters found out about her neighbor's history after the Canadian government began deportation proceedings against him, and she saw his face in the local paper.
It was a shock, and it was quite frightening, and it was also something like a slap on the face, like something that... Isn't it enough what I went through? I wanted to have it all forgotten.
But she can't forget, and she can't escape running into him. A Canadian judge wouldn't keep Kalej in detention because, the judge said, he posed no threat to society.
Whenever I see him, I just turn my head, and if he is in the elevator and I can help it, I just don't go into that elevator and try to avoid him. And that's about all I can do.
It is so absurd that if it wasn't so tragic, it would almost be funny.
Bernie Farber is the spokesman for the Canadian Jewish Congress. He's outraged that someone deported from the United States for war crimes is living in Canada, and that after 2 years, Canadian authorities still haven't been able to kick him out. But Kalej is only one of a long list of names Farber has on file, names of suspected war criminals who have lived for much longer in Canada and have never been tried.
I'm terribly ashamed of my own government on this issue. I'm a proud Canadian, but one area in which Canada let us down, not just the Jewish community, but let Canadians down, is by allowing murderers to live freely and walk freely here.
Over the decades since the war, Jewish organizations like Bernie Farber's have provided the Canadian government with information on hundreds of suspected war criminals living in Canada. According to the Simon Wiesenthal Center, at one time the Canadian government had more than 1,100 cases of suspected war criminals on file.
It was easier in Canada to get into this country after the Second World War if you were a Nazi war criminal than if you were a Jewish refugee. And I know this from my own family's experience. My father languished in a displaced persons camp in Germany after the war, after losing his wife and his children and his entire family. He didn't get to Canada until late 1948, when dozens, if not hundreds, of Nazi war criminals were streaming into this country between 45 and 48.
But the government showed little interest in bringing suspects to justice. Some historians say the former Nazis were useful to Western security organizations during the Cold War and were found safe haven in countries like Canada. Whatever the reason, until the 1980s, there were no trials or deportations of suspected war criminals in Canada. Then, an official commission looked into the issue, and in 1987 reported that about 200 cases required immediate attention. Since then, the government has prosecuted 4 war crimes cases, none successfully, and has only deported 1 alleged Nazi collaborator. Bernie Farber says that record is shameful.
We believe that Canada has a shockingly disgraceful record on dealing with Nazi war criminals, possibly and arguably the worst record of any of the Allied nations after the end of World War II.
John Sims is the Assistant Deputy Attorney General of Canada. It's his uncomfortable job to answer questions about Canada's record on war criminals. Sims says the Canadian government is determined to pursue suspected war criminals. In addition to his case against Mr. Kalej, he has 8 cases against Canadian citizens, and Sims says he'll have another 4 cases in court in the new year. He says he feels the Kalej case is going well. And while he can't do anything about the government's past failures to act, his office is now doing its best to track down war criminals.
It's very difficult. We're trying to prove what happened in the chaos of war 50 years ago. People have died, memories have faded, witnesses are no longer alive. Most of the documents that we needed to prove what it is we're interested in had to come from archives in Eastern Europe and so on.
This explanation doesn't impress Bernie Farber.
You know, interestingly, the United States doesn't seem to have the same kind of problems that we have here in Canada. The United States has an enviable record. They have denaturalized and deported about 70, well, not alleged, 70 war criminals.
But Sims points to countries like Britain, which has only tried one war criminal, and says Canada does not have a worse record than other nations.
We are dedicated to the policy that Canada is not and cannot become a safe haven for war criminals. And we are starting to make headway. It's very difficult work, but I'm confident that we're going to have good results, and soon, that Canadians can be proud of.
Lawyers at the deportation hearing for Conrad Kalej are scheduled to wrap up their arguments in mid-January. Mr. Kalej declined to be interviewed for this report, and Bernie Farber says he looks forward to hearing the result of the court case. For National Public Radio, this is Carolyn Jack in Toronto.
Some stars will be missing from the firmaments in the new year. The performers, the household names and not-so-household names who took their final bows in 1996. Here's critic Bob Mondello.
Maybe it's a coincidence, but I can't help noticing that the trouble the tobacco lobby has been having lately follows close on the heels of the passing this year of George Burns. Burns may have been the only person no one ever wanted to take a cigar away from. He began using them when he was 9 and the century was 5, and for 91 years they punctuated his act, whether he was working solo or with Gracie Allen, the partner who was the love of his life.
Hello, Dad.
Oh, George, hey, George, I have the most exciting news. Guess what? My brother Willie's in the Army.
Well, if everybody buckles down to their jobs, I think we can win the war anyway.
Burns was only the most revered comedian to leave us this year. Count also among the departed essayist Irma Bombeck, ukuleleist Tiny Tim, and two of the most winningly sarcastic figures of television's golden age, Audrey Meadows, whose wifely wisecracks kept Jackie Gleason in line on The Honeymooners, and Maury Amsterdam, whose bald jokes kept Mel in a perpetual fury on The Dick Van Dyke Show. Also, the woman known as the Queen of Country Comedy, stage, radio, and TV star Minnie Pearl.
He says, I know we ain't never been good friends, but says, please, vote for me. I need your vote. Lim says, I wouldn't vote for you if you were St. Peter himself. He says, listen, if I was St. Peter, you couldn't vote for me. You wouldn't be in my district.
Laughter of a more narrative sort was the province of a couple of screen stars from the 30s and 40s who were memorialized this year. Dorothy L'Amour, the sarong-wearing sidekick of Bob Hope and Bing Crosby in their road movies, passed away in September, just 2 months after the death of Claudette Colbert, who was both the best actress ever to grace screwball comedy and a road conjurer in her own right. She proved that in the hitchhiking scene from It Happened One Night, when Clark Gable couldn't get a ride by sticking out his thumb, but she could by sticking out a shapely ankle. Graceful and sophisticated, she charmed audiences for more than 3 decades with eyes that glittered and a throaty laugh that sounded like music. In the world of music, 1996 felt like the end of an era, and it was. Father of bluegrass Bill Monroe, jazz saxophonist Jerry Mulligan, Tea for Two lyricist Irving Caesar, bandleader Mercer Ellington, and composer Morton Gould, who broke down the barrier between pop and classical music with his boogie-woogie etude, all joined the Celestial Choir this year, where they were no doubt singing a welcome to the First Lady of Jazz, the incomparable Ella Fitzgerald. Mel Torme once called Ella the best singer on the planet, and there's no question that the scatting she invented inspired a whole generation of crooners, both on stage and in the privacy of their showers, including a guy who died this year having made singing in a summer shower one of the most ecstatic experiences ever captured on film. in the first age that has been able to capture performance by recording it, a great comfort when contemplating the passing of Gene Kelly.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain, what a glory.
Describing his dancing could never do it justice, but the films he made will let future generations appreciate him in ways they'll never appreciate Nijinsky. Film will also confer immortality on Greer Garson, who was a 40s vision of noble womanhood in films like Mrs. Miniver, and French film director Marcel Carné, who made millions cry with the sentimental wartime classic Children of Paradise. Both died in relative obscurity this year, long after their careers were over, but their accomplishments live on in video stores. And though Italian sex symbol Marcello Mastroianni is no longer with us, we've not heard the last of him, since his final film, aptly entitled Three Lives and Only One Death, is just now being released in this country. Almost unnoticed a few months before Mastroianni's passing last week was the death of his younger brother, Ruggero, who collaborated with Federico Fellini and Lina Wertmüller on many of their classics. I'm indebted for that fact to Variety, the showbiz Bible, which kept track this year not just of the deaths of stars, but also of lesser-known pop culture personalities, the producers like Top Gun money man Don Simpson and 007 impresario Albert Broccoli, the screenwriters like Steve Tesich, who wrote the bike race movie Breaking Away, and the critics like Claudia Cassidy, who championed an unknown youngster named Tennessee Williams when the Glass Menagerie was about to close in Chicago rather than going on to Broadway. Also, Walter Kerr, the New York Times drama critic who was quite possibly the century's most elegant writer on theater. He was also my personal hero, so I'll close this far from complete showbiz necrology with him and a song from a show he co-wrote with his wife, Jean Kerr. Somehow the lyrics, as with all his writing, seem effortless and apt. I'm Bob Mondello.
Oh, I've been sad before, and I've been had before, but oh, my friend, I won't pretend it was as bad before. I should have told my heart to stop and count ten, but then I never know when to say when. I know my way around, I never play around. Each time I fall, I bet my all, he's gonna stay around. It seems that everything is rosy, and then somehow I never know when to say when. But now I've learned.
You're listening to NPR, National Public Radio.
Support for this program comes from National Public Radio member stations and Hewlett-Packard, providing computer, communications, and measurement products for business, industry, science, education, and personal use. Ghosts of Mississippi, a Rob Reiner film, now at select theaters. And the Genevieve Davis Ginsburg Trust, in support of the women of NPR who have helped to make it a unique organization. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Frank Stacia with these news headlines. Leftist rebels have released more hostages from the Japanese ambassador's residence in Lima, Peru. The latest release follows face-to-face talks between the guerrillas and the government's negotiator. The White House insists that a presidential aide did not solicit contributions from Asian Americans. Spokesman Lanny Davis says Doris Matsui scrupulously avoided fundraising in her post as director of the White House outreach to Asian Americans. More paralyzing winter weather is moving into the Northwest. The National Weather Service has issued winter storm warnings and watches for Washington and northern Oregon. Up to 10 inches of additional snow is possible in some areas. And more than 1,000 Jews descended on Hebron today in the last show of support before most of the West Bank city is turned over to the Palestinians. That's a look at some of the stories in today's news.
If you had the patience to pore over 3,000 pages of documents that the Democratic National Committee released last week, you would find a fascinating tale about how desperate the Democrats were to raise money for the presidential election and exactly how they set out to do it. The details shed new light on why the Democrats pumped wealthy Asian executives for contributions, even though in some cases it was illegal. New York Times reporter Tim Weiner has been scrutinizing the documents, and he says the evidence shows the Democratic leaders began hatching this strategy after the 1992 election.
Their goal was to raise $7 million from Asian Americans, and their thinking was that this was the fastest growing immigrant group in America, that it was untapped largely by the Democrats, and that fundraising and political outreach, including invitations to the White House, might reverse the vote in 1992 when President Bush got, I believe it was 55% of the Asian vote, and the president only a third.
Now, there's a logical link missing here for me, and that is, if I want to get more Asian Americans to vote for us, why will I ask them to contribute money? Why will that win their support?
John Wong, according to the contributors that we've talked to, developed a very fine-tuned pitch.
And he, of course, was the Democratic fundraiser.
He was on the Democratic National Committee and was responsible for raising money from Asian Americans. And the pitch was this. You are underrepresented in the high councils of power. In fact, you're barely represented at all. The path to power is giving money, and it will open doors for this generation and for the next generation. And in some cases, he meant that quite literally, in that the doors to the White House were opened to these Asian American contributors who got to occasionally meet the president.
And as Weiner sifted through the documents from the Democratic National Committee, he found one example after another where Huang persuaded an Asian donor to write a big check, and the very same day, or perhaps a few days later, the donor would get to meet the president. Weiner says the most the donors seemed to receive in return for their generosity was a special pin to wear on their lapels and a photo of them standing next to the president. He says there's no evidence that the president gave any special concessions.
The selling point on policy was that the president had already done good things for various subgroups in the Asian American community. You couldn't buy a policy change. I don't think there's any evidence of that. But your point of view could be heard.
I guess one possible interpretation of this has been that the Democrats were so desperate for campaign money that they, in some cases, broke the fundraising law to get it. But another possible interpretation might be that some foreign executives are so desperate for a moment with the president and a snapshot to hang on their wall that they'll write $250,000 to get it. What's your interpretation?
Well, I think they're both true, and there is a third interpretation, which is this. Asian Americans have been excluded from the political and policymaking process. And when John Wong made that pitch, he hit a chord. There's no question that you can increase your political power by giving money. Now, the problem arises when John Wong goes overseas to solicit this money, or when the people who give the money are acting, to put it bluntly, as fronts for other people, when they themselves are not the true donors.
By the way, have you had a chance to talk with any of the Asian executives who gave these big checks, and have you asked them, how do you feel? Do you feel abused, or are you happy you gave it?
Yes, and they're not all executives. We interviewed a man who was a Library of Congress employee who was persuaded by Mr. Wong to buy $25,000 worth of tickets to a Clinton fundraising party, a very substantial chunk of his government salary. And he said, look, I've lived in Washington a very long time, 40 years. Nobody ever asked me for a large contribution. And when Mr. Wong said, you should participate, I said, great.
So he's happy.
He was, and gave gladly. But now, I mean, that there are so many questions surrounding this, I think the next time some of these folks may not be too happy to participate.
Did the Democrats use any strategies here that are truly unusual and surprising, or have past Democratic administrations and the Republican administrations used much the same strategies to woo rich business people in those times?
What is different about the 1996 campaign is the amount of money. The techniques are not different, but the amounts of money are staggering compared to previous years. The Democrats raised more than $250 million. The Republicans raised $400 million. And the press to buy TV time became so great that the pressure to raise money grew greater and greater.
New York Times reporter Tim Weiner, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
All this week, our colleagues here at NPR who track the worlds of science and politics and international affairs have been reflecting on the events of 1996 and predicting what will make news in the new year. And this evening, we've asked NPR's John Burnett to explore trends in religion. Welcome.
Hi, Danny.
John, of course, one of the most notable developments here in America this past year was the continued efforts of the religious right to shape political debate, right, and shape the political agenda in Congress. But it was a mixed year for the religious right in that sense, wasn't it?
Well, it really was, Danny. The religious right promised that it was going to deliver, I think, a lot more than it did in the end. I mean, they talked about these 45 million voter guides they were going to send out to 125,000 churches. But the results at the polls didn't seem to meet the expectations. You know, everyone always looks at the top of the ballot when they try to judge the power of the religious right in the United States. And in a way, I think that's not really the best place to look. Ralph Reed, the executive director of the Christian Coalition, himself once said, "I'd rather have 2,000 school boards than the White House." And I think that's the place where you can see both the current power and the potential for growth also of conservative Christians in the country.
Well, do you see, as you travel around the country, do you see religious right groups gaining power in grassroots areas?
Oh, yeah. It's incredible. I mean, in Texas alone, the entire state Republican organization is dominated by Christian conservatives, as it is in 12 other states. And in 16 other states, the Christian conservatives have a lot of influence. I was at a precinct convention meeting last spring in Houston, which was the most basic level of politics in a way. It goes from there to a state Senate district, from there to the state convention, and from there to the national convention. But I watched a sort of a Christian fundamentalist conservative man who was the president of his convention, and he passed resolution after resolution just like he had people jumping through hoops. I mean, he ran this convention so smoothly because people turned out, they dominated this grassroots process, and they passed some really very extreme sorts of resolutions, things like, you know, the police will go to places where homosexuals gather and round them up for HIV testing. But I really think that this sorts of grassroots activism is very much alive and well because people are so fired up over these issues, these social issues that their kids are facing.
One thing that's curious when we talk about religious activists is that we tend to focus on religious Christians. We very seldom hear about politically active Muslims in this country, other than Louis Farrakhan and the Black Muslims. Are there politically active Islamic groups in America?
Well, that's a good question, because Muslims in America are growing at a very fast rate, and as we're frequently told, they now outnumber, you know, Episcopalians and Presbyterians put together. They're not terribly active as sort of acting out their faith in politics, and yet they are present, and I think becoming more so. For the first time this year, they were invited to the White House during the holy month of Ramadan by Hillary Rodham Clinton, and they consider that to be, you know, an important step. And you also hear them on questions of the freedom of religious expression, because Muslims are concerned, just as Jews and other faiths, non-Christian faiths, are, that as the religious right pushes things like the school prayer amendment, that's going to somehow nationalize Christianity.
Since you've taken on this beat of covering religion, is there something that you've learned about religion in America that has surprised you, that you didn't expect when you took on this area?
Well, it's not just since I took on this beat, Danny. I guess it's since I've been covering the Southwest for NPR for the last 10 years. I didn't expect that religion would keep cropping up again and again in such important ways in really some of the major stories that I've worked on. Take the Oklahoma City bombing, when the faith was the subtext of much of the aftermath of that, both in how the rescuers persevered, in the city's recovery. They were praised, you know, around the country for the way they held up after that. I saw this time and time again, and yet it rarely made it into copy in a way. I think I fell into the same trap that a lot of reporters do, that, well, religion is something that you can't really qualify, you can't quantify it, and so, you know, I'm not going to talk about it. Same thing in the Branch Davidians. It showed the power of one charismatic leader over a small group who believe that their leader has the exclusive truth. And by the same token, the government underestimated the power of religious belief in the lives of the Branch Davidians. And I think, they didn't anticipate the apocalyptic end to that standoff that some religious scholars said was going to happen, and those who followed the Davidians. So, I came up against religion time and time again as this powerful motivating force in people's lives, and that's why it's been so satisfying for the past 6 months to actually cover just religion and really get into that.
NPR's John Burnett speaking to us from Austin, Texas. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Danny.
Beginning next Wednesday, January 1st, it will become easier for white families to adopt African-American children. Until now, some adoption agencies have been reluctant to place black kids in white homes. The social workers have turned away white adoptive parents, hoping that black parents would come along. But a new federal law will forbid that. Activists who lobbied for the change say it will help put more black orphans in good homes faster. Critics say the new policy is naive. Minnesota Public Radio's John Biewen reports.
2-year-old Anthony Walsh vocalizes happily while riding around the kitchen on his mother's hip. Anthony's 7-year-old brother, Benjamin, asks his father if he can take a break from homework.
How close are you to being done?
1, 2, 3.
Benjamin and Anthony are black. Their parents, Paul Walsh and Pamela Huey, are white. When they adopted Benjamin as an infant 7 years ago, the couple lived in Washington, D.C. They did not set out to adopt a black child. They wanted a healthy baby, and most children available in D.C. were black. 5 years later, after they'd moved to Minneapolis, they wanted to adopt again. This time, they did set out to adopt a black child, believing that would be best for Benjamin. They went back to the agency in Washington instead of pursuing adoption locally, partly because Minnesota was one of 3 states with a heritage preservation law, requiring that preference be given to families of the same race as the child. Pamela Huey.
I think we felt a little bit intimidated by the law here. There certainly seemed to be sort of a message in Minnesota that transracial adoptions were difficult and in some circles were frowned upon.
As of January 1st, that's supposed to change. Last fall, Congress passed a law making it illegal to use race as a reason for denying or delaying an adoption. The change doesn't apply to American Indians because of tribal sovereignty. With the new law, the federal government has weighed in dramatically in a long-running, sometimes bitter debate about transracial adoption. It's a debate that touches on painful and complicated questions about race in America. In 1972, the National Association of Black Social Workers declared transracial adoption a form of genocide. In recent years, the group has softened its position somewhat, but stands by the idea that black children should be raised by black families. Retired Senator Howard Metzenbaum of Ohio says that philosophy is hurting black children. He points to studies showing that black children make up a disproportionate 40% of children waiting for adoption, and that they wait longer in foster care than white children do.
The ideal situation is that there would be an adequate number of black adoptive parents to take all of the black children that are up for adoption. Unfortunately, that's not the reality.
Metzenbaum touts his credentials as a liberal Democrat and longtime ally of the civil rights movement. He authored a 1994 law intended to prevent states from using race as the primary factor in choosing adoptive families. Last fall, he went back to Capitol Hill as a private citizen to lobby for the complete ban on race preference. Metzenbaum says he's motivated by cases, some still in the courts, in which black children who'd spent years in the homes of white foster parents were removed because of race when the white families tried to adopt them.
There isn't any good logical reason why a white parent that wants to adopt a child of a different color, if that's good for the child and the court decides it's in the best interest of the child, then we should not stand in the way of that adoption taking place.
But some black social workers say transracial adoption is potentially as damaging as moving a child from one home to another. Tony Oliver heads an adoption agency in Atlanta and co-chairs the Adoption Task Force for the National Association of Black Social Workers.
Given the volatile nature of race in this society, it is certainly easier for children to be raised in environments where they have an opportunity to not stick out or not to feel as though there's something different about them.
Oliver says the long wait suffered by black children is a complicated problem. She says there's no clear evidence that race matching is the main culprit. The children who wait the longest are often older kids who've been abused or neglected. Oliver says most white families who want to adopt are looking for healthy infants and toddlers. Lester Collins, who heads the Council on Black Minnesotans, says social service workers need to do a better job of recruiting black families, many of whom are suspicious of bureaucracies.
Frankly, the system has not known how to recruit them, and the system itself is still largely a white, male-run institution, and supervisors and counselors and people who do family home studies largely do not look like myself, and I contend that that is and has been the challenge.
But Denise Ravels Robinson, who oversees adoption and foster care programs for the state of Minnesota, says some social workers have focused on race too much in their searches for adoptive families. She says presented with biracial children, some county caseworkers have looked for potential adoptive parents on the black side of the child's family while ignoring white relatives. Given the perception that many social workers believe strongly in race matching, some wonder whether the new federal law will really change things. Robinson says her department has asked the federal government if caseworkers can use culture, if not race, to match children with adoptive families.
What has been the way of life for this child in terms of language, in terms of beliefs, in terms of the kind of values that have been communicated to that child, and also some of the beliefs that the parents may have based on who they are, that they would want to see continued as this child is raised?
Such talk distresses former Senator Metzenbaum. He worries that social workers opposed to transracial adoption will undermine the new law by using culture as a stand-in for race. One thing everyone seems to agree on is that white families who do adopt black children need to make strong efforts to connect their children with other black people. Some blacks who were raised in white homes say they suffered psychological isolation. On the other hand, studies have found that black children raised in white homes generally fare as well as those raised in black families and grow into adults with strong racial identity.
Can you remember any of the African pledge?
I say it every day.
You say it every day?
Yeah.
Can you just say it once for us?
Okay.
The Minneapolis couple, Pam Huey and Paul Walsh, live in a mixed-race neighborhood. Their Methodist church has a black minister and an integrated congregation, and they send 7-year-old Benjamin to a private Afrocentric school where he recites the African pledge and sings the African-American national anthem.
Let every boy set sick till earth in heaven ring.
Pamela Huey says her family's experience has convinced her that transracial adoption can be a healing influence in society.
And it's something that just occurred to me in the last few years when I realized how incredible the love of a parent for child is, and I think it's probably the most intense love there is. And you take and you cross racial lines with that love, and the benefits just are astounding. One, we've enriched our lives, and then you take to the grandparents and the aunts and the uncles, and all of a sudden, all these people that have never been exposed to a black person are loving a child because he's their niece or nephew or their grandchild.
Those on all sides of the debate say they'll be watching closely to see if the new federal law actually helps find adoptive homes for the thousands of black children who need them. For National Public Radio, I'm John Biewen.
Storyteller Alice McGill grew up on a farm, and for her family, the white man in the big house symbolized promise and limits.
After working 12 long months on a sharecropper's farm, by picking the cotton, shaking the peanuts, threshing the wheat, and hoeing the crops. December spelled end of work. Holiday buying and going to town. For days and days, Pa had waited for his appointed settlement time. Where, you know, sharecroppers weren't always sure that they'd even clear dime. Last that morning, Ma fixed the best breakfast to give Pa a nice full start. Me and Sonny rushed to the lot so we could hitch old Maud up to the cot, and Ma stood in the door and bade Pa farewell with a firm and stout warning. Pa, she said, you take heed now, and beware, you hear? Keep your eyes and ears open. That boss man may not be fair. Pa assured her that he could handle any man, figure of fact. I know how much credit we owe, he said. The rest is mine. That's that. We were standing at the end of the yard, Sonny, me, and Claude and all, as Pa drove out of sight on the cot and the back of old Maud. Then it was time to get to work, getting the house ready for the holiday. We were washing the windows and hanging the curtains and putting the littlest ones out to play. I was 9, so my play days were over, but an easy task for me was picked. Still, I dreamed over my work and my imagination played tricks on me. Suppose, I thought, Pa got mad with the boss and knocked him in the head. They'd all come a-hunting with their guns, and then Pa'd be dead. Get on away from me, bad thoughts. But it had happened once before, to a good man down the road, and he sure ain't round no more. I snapped back to the task at hand. The others had kept on working. Dust was flying, mop scrubbing. They hadn't even noticed my shirking away from my work. But then I heard just a slight creaking, like it was coming up the hill. That could be nothing else but Pa's bad cartwheel. All of us legged out to meet him, each bounded out in kind. For once, I forgot that baby and left him way behind. Pa said gleefully as we ran beside the cot, children, get ready and forget your blues. This good papa of yours is bringing all good news. We helped him in the house, everybody wondering what he'd brought. He eased his hand in his hip pocket just like he knew what we thought. Looking like a magic man, he clicked his heels and pulled out 7 $100 bills. He reached in his shirt pocket, nice and nifty, then pulled out another 50. Ma just beamed and said little. Pa was doing all the gabbing. A word couldn't get in edgewise, so we all jumped around laughing and talking like puppies yapping. Pa said how fine-looking my children would go to school. Ma, I got enough money to burn up a wet mule. All the girls got new coats, the boys fine new shirts. After dresses and shirts and sweaters, there was plenty left for boots. Sam, the namesake of Pa, sat right down and began to plead. He wanted us to take back his knickerbockers because he was so knock-kneed. I snickered under my breath when I looked at him, and I witness to this day. Sam's two knees came together to form the letter K. Ma had a heap in the kitchen that year, 46. The house smelled so good all the time. We were never in a better fix. I declare I had enough oranges to last me till July. But after starting on them, in 3 days, they'd gone. I was so secure and content after that first big settlement. I wish the story could end here, but Pa had other thoughts in his mind. In order to stay on the top, he had to think ahead of time. Pa said, a man don't have 2 good years right straight in a row, and this boss man is setting me up for 3 bad years or more. I can't let him catch on yet that I have an answer to his groove. Wife and children come first of the year. We'll move. And we did.
Storyteller Alice McGill comes to us from Columbia, Maryland. And for this evening, that's All Things Considered.
Thank you.
editor is Jonathan Broder. Fred Wasser, our director. The show is produced tonight by Rebecca Davis, with Devar Ardalan, Eva Grant, Van Williamson, and Jim Lesher. Barbara Rehm is our assistant managing editor. Key Molesky, our reference librarian. Paris Morgan is our technical director. Audio engineers are Michael Cullen, Gary Henderson, Renee Pringle, Vaughn Williams, Tom Carpenter, John Widoff, and Roderick Brobleck. Newscast producers are Kathy Rushlow and Jana Domowitz, and I'm Daniel Zwerdling. Thanks for joining us for All Things Considered.
NPR is solely responsible for this program. Tapes and transcripts are available. Call toll-free 1-888-NPR-NEWS anytime. That's 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Support for this program comes from NPR member stations and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting public understanding of technology, industry, and economic growth. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve health and health care for all Americans. The Carnegie Corporation of New York. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research on the development of children, adolescents, and youth. This is NPR, National Public Radio.